On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we remember John Sterling, who passed away at the age of 87, the legendary Yankees broadcaster, before talking about those New York Yankees who look like far and away the best team in the American League, plus five sweeps from the weekend and so much more. It is a jam-packed episode of Baseball Barbacast. Let's get to it.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world brave enough to talk about the New York Yankees. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and it's about time someone spoke about this franchise into microphones, you know?
Got to start somewhere. The Yankees will finally get some credit. We have a lot of baseball from the weekend that we want to talk about, as well as some hockey. Duh, go Sabres. But before we get to showering the Yankees with well-deserved praise, we have some breaking news, some very sad breaking news that is also very Yankees-related, and that is that the legendary broadcaster John Sterling has passed away at the age of 87. This is news that just hit our timelines minutes before we started recording, and we were already planning on spending the first chunk of our show talking about the Yankees, but now we should definitely pause and, you know, tip our caps to John Sterling, one of the greatest to ever do it, and someone that I know you living in New York for a good chunk. I'm sure you ran into him a few times, and this is someone that means a lot to a lot of people as someone who was the voice of the Yankees for this long. So, of course, there will be much more elaborate and exhaustive obituaries and, you know, remembrances of his career elsewhere, but we certainly wanted to acknowledge him before we started, because, yeah, I mean, even for us as non-Yankees fans who have only been doing this for so long, John Sterling is the definition of iconic, I would say. And so, yeah, just wanted to make sure we just mention him before we get started. But do you have any specific Sterling memories? Again, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know how much you encountered him in the Yankee Stadium press box and whatnot, but go ahead and share anything you have.
So, you know, not a Yankee fan, not someone who grew up listening to John Sterling, but then spent, you know, 4 years. He stopped calling games in 24. I started being around every day in 22. So I was really just like 3 years of being around him. There was no way he knew my name. But he, every single time I interacted with him, you felt better after having talked to him. He was a riot. He was a hoot. He was insightful. He moved like an institution all his own. Like, he would just go into the press box dining area and just kind of float in there to like get a cup of water, and he'd like float out. He's like humming some opera to himself from 1962 that you've never heard of. And I think what I appreciate the most about John Sterling is that he was having a good time. He thoroughly understood that baseball, above all else, was entertainment. And by having a good time himself, he was able and very skilled at kind of amplifying that good time to the people of the tri-state area that listened to him every day. Now, things were made a little bit easier for him because most of the Yankees teams he was calling games for were winning an outrageous amount. And so everyone was usually having a good time. But Sterling just nailed the era and the tone of the Yankees, where it was both, he both made it sound important, but he also, and I don't mean this in a bad way, could be delightfully campy, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that is a very difficult crossover to hit, that balance between fun and seriousness, between intensity and joy. And I thought Sterling was particularly skilled at this. And I would say that for us, like, the home run calls are what you remember, because no one else was doing bits as often and as unapologetically, as blatantly as John Sterling. After every home run call, each player, this is for those of you, you know, who were not listening to Yankees games, each player got their own little, you know, sign off, their own little phrase after they went deep. Some of them are absolutely incredible.
Yeah, and we could reminisce on those for an entire podcast, and we've certainly made jokes about them over the years. But I think it's also cool because John Sterling broadcasted long enough for those calls to become social media sensations. You know, he would already call thousands and thousands of games before Twitter was a thing. And for his, for that to become, you know, it shouldn't be reductive to where it was like, that's what his whole career was, because as I mentioned, he had obviously already called so many other games well before anyone was laughing at Higashioka, the home run stroker. But it goes back to your first point. You know, he was having a good time with it, and he was able to kind of blend that, what it means to call the Yankees and know that a lot of people are listening, but also put his spin on it. So I'm sure there are Yankees fans listening who have much more specific or longer ago memories about John Sterling and what he means to them. So feel free to share those, baseballbarbiecast@gmail.com. But yeah, when you mention running into people, and I've been fortunate enough to have this in Cleveland to a degree with some of the people that have been around Cleveland for a long time. Of course, Tom Hamilton, the broadcaster, but even like a beat writer like Paul Hoynes, who's been doing this for 40 years. When you're around people that have been in this game for this long, there's something that's just kind of shocking about it. And you just think about all the baseball that they've seen and all the baseball that they've covered. And when you see them still coming to the ballpark and still doing the work, there's that of, oh my God, they're still doing this. And then there's just thinking about how much baseball they've experienced and that they are still getting to experience this current version of baseball. And it is cool that John Sterling was doing it all the way almost to the very end of his life. And so a heck of a baseball life that he lived. And so, yeah. Rest in peace, John Sterling. And as you mentioned, like, please, as I mentioned, just let us know if you have anything more.
5,060 consecutive games called is just preposterous. 5,060 consecutive regular season games called. First missed the game in July of 2019. Like, he started in 1989. It's outrageous.
It's absurd.
It's absurd, right?
It's absurd. Yeah.
Like that level of consistency and reliability and like clocking in every day. You know, I, as a kid, I was in love with Cal Ripken because he played every day. That was the thing that my parents told me was important, that Cal Ripken worked every day. So for John Sterling, in a lot of ways, was the broadcast version of that. So cheers to him. What a career. What a legend. What an icon. Thoughts and prayers to his family. A baseball life well lived. All right, let's pivot now from a Yankees icon to a bunch of Yankees wins. That's our opener. The New York Yankees are the best team in the American League. It's not really that close at all. We've not talked about them a bunch on this show because they haven't been particularly dramatic in the way that they've gone about racking up their wins. And in an April that was filled with drama, fired managers and various and not unfired managers in the case of Carlos Mendoza, and a whole lot of consternation about this league, the Yankees were just winning a lot of ball games. But it's about time we chat about them. They took all three games over the weekend against the Baltimore Orioles. They will play again today on Monday to try and complete the mop. None of these games were particularly close. 7-1 on Friday, 9-4 on Tuesday, and then it was 4-3 heading into the eighth on Sunday for the Yankees, pounced for 7 runs in the eighth inning, giving Andrew Kittredge quite a swirly. They take all three games against the O's. They are rolling.
I think the only time we really locked in on the Yankees was a few weeks ago when they got swept in Tampa. And that was the same weekend, I think, that the Mets also had gotten swept, one of the weekends that the Mets had gotten swept. And we were like, oh, man, look at these two teams, these two New York teams. Ha ha, they both got swept. And we were pretty consistent that we were a lot more concerned about the Mets than the Yankees. I feel pretty good about that. However, since then, the Mets have continued to lose and the Yankees have gone 15-4. So that is why we sit here today and talk about them as the best team in the American League and one of the best teams in baseball. And it's not just that their record is 23-11, which is only a game and a half better than the Rays, who have also won a bunch of baseball games. But if you do look at the run differential, it's comical. They are now at +65 this season. which the second best run differential in the American League belongs to Detroit, who is only a game over 500, and they're at plus 18. In fact, only two other teams in the AL even have a positive run differential. That is Tampa at plus 7 and Seattle, who just got swept, at plus 2. So maybe we overrate run differential. I know people maybe are sometimes tired of us referencing it, but I do think even in a small sample, it could be a good proxy for just how much better these teams are playing. And the Yankees have just been kicking the crap out of most of their competition for much of the season. This weekend, very much included, where even where it might be tight early on in the game, they are really starting to click up and down the lineup now, where for a while it was Judge and Rice were essentially doing everything. Now they're starting to get contributions from other guys. And with the pitching that they have, which is only about to get even better, that's why they are really overwhelming opponents.
Yeah, let's talk about what's been going right. Why are the Yankees so good? Aaron Judge is the answer to that question every year. He is the answer to that question again. You know the deal. His numbers are almost exactly in line with what he always does. The OPS is 1031. He, I believe, is leading the league in home runs with 13. He's doing Aaron Judge things. The decline is not happening in 2026. But the most important development for this team is Ben Rice turning into more than just a sidekick. I went and looked at Judge's tenure in New York. And basically every single season of Judge's career, he has had a different second best hitter underneath him. Mm-hmm. That has been Stanton at times. How healthy is Stanton in a given season? Right now he's on the IL. There was like a DJ LeMahieu year. There was a Cody Bellinger season. There was a Luke Voit season. Like there was a Gleyber season. Like Juan Soto season. Right? Like there's always a year. There's been a different number two under Judge every year. And now it's very much Ben Rice, who is leading the league by hitting all three of these categories. 343, 455, 759 for a 1214 OPS. He has 12 homers. He's walked 23 times, struck out 32. He's raking. He has been unbelievable, legitimately elite hitter. Those two guys, for the most part, have been carrying the load for this offense that, besides those two, to be honest with you, has kind of underwhelmed. Like, if I told you that the Yankees had been this dominant to this point in the season, you would have assumed that they would have gotten more contributions from Jazz and Grisham and Wells and Stanton, even McMahon. That hasn't been the case. It's been Rice. It's been Judge. It's been a bunch of good Bellinger, like very good Bellinger. Caballero, the underlying, we'll get to this shortstop kerfuffle in a bit. Don't worry. Anthony Volpe in AAA. Caballero has been fine, even though the underlying stuff says he's not fine, he's actually bad. But for the most part, it's been 2.5 guys with Bellinger carrying this offense. But the pitching is good enough where that's worked totally, totally fine. Max Fried, Cam Schlittler, Ryan Weathers, and Will Warren have all been spectacular, with Schlittler the early favorite to win the AL Cy Young.
He is certainly in the mix there. He is slated to pitch on Monday night against Baltimore, going for the mop. So that puts them in very good position. Before we go to the pitching and talk about the shortstop stuff, I do want to go back to Rice for a second and Judge. Ben Rice is hitting 367, 457, 867 against lefties. Would you look at that, folks? This guy, they finally put him in there. Now he's in the lineup every game. There's no hiding it. And even, I know that's only 35 plate appearances, but he's got 5 homers against left-handed pitching. And now Aaron Boone should not have to really ever think about whether Ben Rice is going to be in the lineup or not. And so, yeah, he has been unbelievable. And his line looks like Aaron Judge line. I will say part of this is because I think the last few weeks it has looked more like Aaron Judge. But on the whole, I think it is still so far a tick down to what it has been. The strikeouts are up a little bit. He's only hitting 264. Part of what has made Judge so impossible to comprehend the last few seasons is that he was competing for batting titles. And maybe he can heat up to the point where he's doing that again. But I would say he has been at least a little bit more pitchable this season, relatively.
Jordan.
But on the whole, he is still terrible. Yeah. I'm just saying. The standard was the standard.
The OPS starts with a one. It starts with a one. I know that he started a little bit slow. It doesn't start with two ones. Okay. I know it's one,
which
zero.
It has.
I get it.
Which it has for the last three seasons. And so this is the same thing when we're talking about the Sotos, and there's a few, the same thing with Ohtani. When you are at the best in the world level, when you are merely a top five player instead of obviously the best player, I will hold you to that. However, over the last few weeks, he has been closer to the 1100, 1200 OPS.
Yeah, don't
and
worry with Ben about Rice, this
yeah,
man.
It doesn't. It's, he's fine. Yeah, no. This is, I'm not voicing this as a point of concern. I am just saying Ben Rice has been better, which is amazing.
Yeah,
The fact that they are both on the team, they don't have to pick between the two. They have both of these guys, and that's also important because, as you mentioned, the rest of the lineup has only been so good. Bellinger's starting to heat up. Stanton is indeed injured, as I speculated when we heard that Jason Dominguez was coming up. So that part is always, although it doesn't sound too serious, but you never know with Stanton. But when you have two of the best hitters in the league, two of the three to four best hitters in the league, you are going to be just fine. And then as for the pitching, I mean, the fact that they're going to get Cole and Rodon back at some point here, you know, they just called up Elmer Rodriguez, who's will maybe take a couple starts, but Weathers has started to look better. What Will Warren has become this season should not be a huge surprise considering what he was last year as a rookie, which was a really impressive rookie starter. He was not amazing. He was not dominant the whole way, but for him to make, 33 starts last year as a rookie, strike out more than a guy per inning. It should not surprise us that this Yankees team that has proven on the pitching side to have these guys to be able to get better and get better and get better. Why should we be shocked that Will Warren has continued to get better after kind of showing us a really impressive floor last year? So that's a huge development. We know Luis Gil is the one that has gone in the complete wrong direction, but they can afford that because they have these other guys that are coming back, and maybe he reemerges as a bullpen guy as well. So they just have so many options on the mound. I'm still a little bit underwhelmed in the bullpen, I have to say. I think that is still a group that I would imagine they will reinforce at the deadline in some form. Maybe they just call up LeGrandhe and say, go for it, dude. Go throw a billion miles an hour. I think that's probably what's going to happen at some point because there's obviously no room for him in the rotation. But when your starting pitching is this good, and Bednar is certainly good, I they're in good shape. So the bullpen worries me a little bit. But otherwise, the rotation's is as good as it gets in baseball besides the Dodgers at full strength. And even then, you could argue the Yankees are still better.
Yeah. I think part of the reason why the Yankees are not just the best team in the American League, but obviously the best team in the American League, is how they've done this and what they've done this without. They've done this without significant contributions from a lot of people in the lineup. They've done this without Gerrit Cole, and they've done this without Carlos Rodon. And so when you project forward, Jazz has to be better. Wells probably has to be better. Bishop has to be better.
Wells, I'm not so McMahon, sure anymore, but it's fine.
Sure. But like, you can, I don't think Austin Wells will have an 85 OPS plus. I think it'll be more around 100. Jazz is not going to be at 75. It'll be closer to 100. Like, I do think the bottom of this order will be better. These players have been better. And then you get Carlos Rodon and Gerrit Cole back in the rotation, and it's like, I don't understand how any other team in the American League can go ahead and challenge this. Okay, let's pivot, though, to the one piece of spiciness going on in Yankee land. Anthony Volpe, minor leaguer, once again. Here is the timeline. Anthony Volpe called up opening day 2023, hotshot prospect. I was there for the debut, and the anticipation was real. I was buying. I was in. I was drinking the Anthony Volpe juice. And then for three seasons, he was worse than pure mid, at least offensively. Wins a gold glove in there. He's hitting home runs. He's stealing bases, but he is not an above average big league hitter. Last year, he screws up his shoulder, diving for a ball, plays through it. Numbers definitely took a hit as a result. Gets offseason surgery. They kind of slow play his return a little bit. They send him on a rehab assignment. Rehab assignments are 20 games. Once that 20 game rehab clock was starting to tick to its end, people were like, huh, Anthony Volpe's still down there. Are they going to call him up and have him be the shortstop when he's healthy? The answer to that turned out to be no, as Volpe was optioned to AAA yesterday, reinstated off the injured list, and immediately optioned to AAA to Scranton, as Jose Caballero will continue to be the everyday shortstop for the New York Yankees. This is a very significant development.
Yeah, so I guess we should talk about Caballero first, because that is the whole point, right? They trade for Jose Caballero last year, and at the time, it's like, great, he's the perfect backup for multiple infield positions. He provides us with an edge. He'll you know, piss some people off on the other team, Zach Benson style.
Runs the base as well.
And he'll play good defense, and, you know, he'll get hit by a bunch of pitches, and he'll be great, perfect utility player to have around.
Guy but who does a lot for a ball club.
He sure does. But then with Volpe out, it's like, great. Well, we have this guy that can play shortstop. So he's just going to play shortstop. And you look at the surface level and you say, all right, well, he's leading the league in steals. He's also leading the league in caught stealing, but he's leading the league in steals. He's got a league average batting line. He's got a few homers, and he's playing a really good shortstop. And Aaron Boone cannot stop praising him. He's just said Caballero is playing a heck of a shortstop. He's done exactly what we need, blah, blah, blah. And so even though the underlying stats offensively suggest that he has been one of the worst hitters in baseball, he is process-wise, Jose Caballero is doing essentially nothing well at the plate. He is striking out a bunch. He is not walking ever. He is not hitting the ball hard. He is not hitting the ball in the air. He's not doing really anything well. But in this small sample, when you combine it with plus base running and plus defense, he has still been at least an average player, if not maybe an above average player. And we're talking about a team that he's batting ninth, and they're not asking him to hit at the top of the lineup. For his role, he is succeeding in that role. But because of all the history with Volpe, the assumption was still just that, and for how highly the organization has continued to talk about Volpe, even as a lot of people outside New York have been like, is this guy actually that good? we all kind of assumed that Volpe would just get his job back when he was ready.
Well, and there was hey, Aaron Boone, Brian Cashman, when Volpe's back, is he going to be the starting shortstop? And at most points, they were like, that is the working assumption. That's the plan. That's how things are going to go. But I also think it's interesting to look at Caballero's offensive numbers, because he got off to a bad start surface level wise, like really bad. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. I think it was right around when they put Volpe on the IL, or they took Volpe off the IL right. to start the rehab. Right. Caballero caught fire. Yeah, he had like a 424 OPS like 2 weeks into the season. Mm-hmm. They throw Volpe on the IL. You know, since April 16th, he's got an 886. So he saw Volpe playing baseball games down in Somerset, and Joey Cabs absolutely locked the F in. And now he's going to be the starting shortstop. And I think let's just pivot to Volpe here. I get this decision because it is so much easier from an optics perspective, both internally and externally, to keep Volpe in the minors when he's been there rehabbing, and to say, oh, he didn't have spring training. He's only had a couple weeks of at-bats. We're going to just treat this like spring training, give him more runway to get back up to speed. We still believe in the guy. It's so much easier to say that than to have him at the big league level and send him down from there. Now, that might sound silly because effectively it is the same outcome, but it is when you're communicating this either to Volpe or to us or to the fans, I think it does play significantly better.
I think you're totally right. And I almost wonder if there's part of them that's like, that's also looking at the Baseball Savant page for Caballero and be like, well, this is going to stop at some point here. And once Caballero falls into the 1-for-30 and whatever, sure. Okay, you move him back to the bench. However, what that does not do, and this is where I think I can kind of leave it here and we can take a break. although I do want you to just give one more forecast for your expectations for Volpe.
Yeah.
While I do not think this is going to torpedo the Yankee season, no matter how it goes, because we've seen the rest of their team is quite good, and this is just going to be an interesting subplot to follow. Regardless of whether it's the right move, the wrong move, the optics, all these things, it is a fascinating moment in the career of Anthony Volpe. Both how the organization views him, both whether they actually do give him the opportunity to be the starting shortstop again, because I do believe they don't want him to come up and be the bench player. I think they do still want him to be the shortstop. However, as many Yankees fans have pointed out, this is a player now who has three full seasons of a 280 on base percentage, which usually does not continue to get run as a starting everyday player. So if he can prove that he can be better than that, which is a tall task coming off shoulder surgery when you didn't have spring training and all these other things, I don't really know why I should have confidence that he's suddenly going to become this impact player that they believed that he could be, that a lot of us believed he could be when he was a prospect. But that would be my last point, is however important it is for the Yankees, I am really interested as to just where Anthony Volpe goes from here, because it is a challenging spot for him, and he has a lot to prove because of the last time, for what we've seen for the bulk of his major league career, which has been bad hitting. I know he's had the power and the speed, but you cannot tell me he has been a good hitter. He has just not been. So there's a lot to prove on that. And that comes with getting healthy from shoulder surgery, which is no small thing.
Yeah. Okay. So who do you think starts at shortstop for the Yankees' first postseason game? I don't want to pencil them into October, but come on. Right.
I don't know.
They're going to play October baseball, and someone will be playing shortstop, and it will either be Anthony Volpe or Jose Caballero.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
And so
we know they'll be there.
If I had to pick, I would pick Volpe. I think that a Caballero slump is incoming. I think that Volpe, even with all of his faults, is a better everyday player than Caballero at shortstop. I think that his defensive issues last year were not fundamental range arm. It was more booting easy stuff that torpedoed his numbers. I think that's more fixable. I don't think he's ever going to win a Silver Slugger, but I do think that there's enough ability in the bat, in the offensive profile, even still, that I think he can be a viable, playable, everyday big league shortstop. I really do. And maybe I'm going to be the last person to jump off that ship and I'll sink. I get that. I understand. I think Anthony Volpe is a better player than Jose Caballero. It doesn't mean Caballero is bad. It doesn't mean Caballero is not going to help this team. I just think that over the long run, Volpe going to the minors and just kicking ass for a little bit probably will feel good for him. It will be weird though, because Volpe, they have stood by him at every single turn. And on Wednesday, he's going to play an 11:05 a.m. start in Worcester, Massachusetts. Okay. During his rehab, I don't think he went on the road, right? It was just Somerset and Scranton back and forth, and they would just move his rehab between the two. And so, we're going to get Volpe in a weird, silly uniform. People are going to dunk on him for that. We're going to get him at 11 a.m. He's going to have to wear it a little bit here for a couple of weeks before they call him up.
Just turned 25. And look, man, you assume he's going to go down there and be one of the best hitters in AAA. I don't know. I think we're not going to see him for a while. I think we will see him in the majors. I think he will start games at shortstop this season. But there's a lot going on here. So, like we said, don't think that this is the most important thing happening with the Yankees. But because so many other things are going well, it's not surprising that this becomes very juicy. And the context and history here with this player is truly fascinating. Okay, so much more baseball to talk about. So let's take a break. When we return, five sweeps. Let's get to it. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. I was in Chicago this weekend, watched some Cubbies baseball with my eyes. They were one of five teams to sweep. How sweep is it? It is sweep. How sweep is it? It is.
Queen up, everybody, everybody.
There is no shame in getting swept. I never got swept. You guys got swept.
Five teams going undefeated over the weekend, and we will begin in Chicago with those Cubs that you saw, taking all three over the Arizona Diamondbacks. It began on Friday afternoon, where they tried to slow down Ildemaro Vargas, and they failed as he went 4-for-4, raising his average to 4.04. Oh, my goodness. But that was not enough, as the Cubs still go on to win that one 6-5. The next day, the Ildemaro magic runs out. He goes hitless. Shota Imanaga throws 7 scoreless. Ian Happ hits a big home run. They win 2-0. And then on Sunday, Matt Boyd with a strong start, a homer from the delightful Moises Ballesteros. Michael Busch started to heat up. He's got 2 extra base hits. As the Cubs win 8-4, they've won 12 straight at Wrigley Field. And Jake Mintz, you were at Wrigley Field first as a credentialed member of the media and then as a normie in the bleachers. So tell us about your experience in Chicago.
Dude, Wrigley rips. Wrigley is just great. I had not been there since the literal World Series in 2016. The neighborhood has certainly changed a bit. Taco Bell's gone. And I would say the soul of the neighborhood has not the same as it once was, that's for certain. But once you're in the park, once you're in the bleachers, what a delight. It is a unique environment. It is genuinely special. I had never taken in a game from the bleachers before. That is just as good as it gets. It is the closest to like a college sports or European soccer kind of vibe with the way that the bleachers are a character themselves. And when you're out there, the game, it's not like secondary and people aren't like not locked into the game, but it's like, oh, there's the beer snake getting taken by the, you know, the steward, and everyone boos him. And then he hands the beer snake back and then everyone cheers. And then like someone gets a ball and they hand it to a kid and everyone goes nuts. Like it is its own type of experience. And I just want to go do it again. Like it was so refreshing and invigorating to like take a game in that way. You know, so often I'm wearing pants that like nicer pants and like boots and, you know, a buttoned shirt in the press box. And I got to not do that. I got to not do that. I got to have a beer or two. I got to take my tarp off and I got to sing Go Cubs Go. And it was great. Highly recommend. No notes.
Cubs are they're just kind of doing everything you would want as far as their production. Like, sure, you're still waiting on
the pitching,
PCA a little bit, and the pitching is very injured for sure. The pitching is in a delicate position because of how injured they've been, and yet even with a ton of guys missing, we know some of whom are not coming back, like Cade Horton, which is a huge bummer. But their recipe is looking very similar to what it was last year, which is throw the ball over the plate and let our best defense in baseball cook. They're going to eventually start giving up a lot of home runs, but still.
Sure. As it heats up a little, especially at home, we'll see more homers there. What is the Cubs' superpower? What do they do well, right? What are they elite at? Because when we talk about teams winning the World Series, we've said this time and time again, do you have someone that can be an MVP? Do you really have someone that can win an MVP award? I look at the Cubs offense. I'm not sure I see that person. But what's a little bit different about this club is that the defense is a potential separator. That they play so good out there that they're just stealing outs. And when the whole team's doing that, I think it does raise the operation to a level where you maybe don't need to have like a difference-making hitter. Still, it would really help. And if you're like looking at like who that could be, like which Cub do you think could finish in the top three of MVP voting? Nico Horner?
He's the one that has played. He's, you know, I'm going to write about early awards check-ins this week, and Nico Horner will be absolutely mentioned in the NL discussion because he has been their best player. I know he had a brief injury scare over the weekend. I'm glad it looks like he's fine. Came back, got a couple more hits on Sunday, but everyone's playing really well. You know, Bregman is the one that's now making all the money. And we saw PCA have an MVP run last year. Seiya Suzuki, what he's doing offensively right now, he looks like their most dangerous hitter. But it's just a pretty balanced team. And then, of course, Ballesteros. We know that, as I've mentioned before, it's very much in a platoon role. But he's doing damage when called upon. And so he is making their lineup deeper and more dangerous at the bottom.
Ballesteros is very appreciated. When you're at a Cubs game, and you've had a couple cold ones in the bleachers, the players on the Cubs, because they're all white and between 5'10 and 6'2, they're kind of tough to discern in the building.
Yep.
You know which one Bregman is because he's a little shorter and he runs silly. Dansby has a little more hair. But like, dude, from across the field, separating Bush from Happ, from Horner... You know, it's tough. And so Ballesteros, for that reason, is a great change of pace because you could spot sure. him and his slightly comfier frame from quite a ways away. This guy rakes. There are people that hit and there are people that don't. This guy hits. He hits.
I think the thing I'm thinking about with the Cubs now, with all their injuries, is last year we saw a deadline with them where Jed Hoyer got extended and then was pretty conservative at the deadline. And I know they still went to the postseason, but it still ended up being a pretty disappointing end to their year. This is the team to go in on. We've mentioned how a lot of these guys are about to hit free agency, Suzuki and Happ and Imanaga, some of the other pitchers, et cetera, et cetera. Their farm system is not good. However, there are some pieces that are trending in the right direction. Kevin Alcantara now looks like a very interesting trade piece because of what he's doing in AAA. Pedro Ramirez, another guy who's really heating up. Jed, you got your extension. You're trying to restore the Cubs to trying to accomplish something as the guy, right? Jed Hoyer, as the guy in charge, really has not actually accomplished anything with the Chicago Cubs. This is an incredible opportunity to do so.
In the playoffs.
Exactly. This is an incredible opportunity to do so. They need more pitching. Of course, it's early to really understand who's out there that's available, but I really hope that they're aggressive come deadline time and maybe come before that because of how injured they are, they probably shouldn't sit around and wait. They probably should go out there and try and make something happen. So. But I'm having a ton of fun watching this team. I imagine Cubs fans are too. And yeah, what was their last home loss? I guess Pirates in extra innings back on April 11th. So they have another four games against the Reds coming up this week, which is a very interesting time for the Reds to come to town. As we're about to talk about, they did not have a very good weekend. But they're just, yeah, Cubs are, this is what it should look like. And I'm glad you got to experience that up close.
It was great. Pirates, though, they took all three over the Reds this weekend at home. In Pittsburgh, Henry Davis, 2-home run game in game one as they win 9-1. Win 17-7 in game two. Disaster start from Rhett Lauder. The Reds walk 8 in the first two innings, including 7 in a row, I believe. Which, watching a team walk 7 in a row must be really difficult for most fans. For those of us that have played and experienced Division III baseball, that's just called a Tuesday. Game three of the set, Pirates complete the sweep, 7 2/3 scoreless for Braxton Ashcraft. Chase Burns throws 7 scoreless. The Buccos push one across in the bottom of the eighth on a very timely single from O'Neill Cruz to win 1-0 and complete the sweep. Pirates back in the win column, sweeping after getting mopped last week. The NL Central remains quite a roller coaster.
Yep, so mopped by the Cardinals, and then they go ahead and sweep the Reds at home. First time the Reds have been swept all season. So that is not a small thing. Generally, their pitching and Ellie De La Cruz and Sal Stewart have been able to keep them from falling into any sort of skid. But this was a really impressive response from Pittsburgh after a really, really ugly week against St. Louis. And continuing this theme, as you mentioned, the NL Central, I just have no idea what to make of it, but it's been very fun to watch.
Pirates in last place at 19-16. With that record at 19-16, they would be second in the NL East. They would be first in the AL Central and first in the AL West. And they are last in the NL Central. That division is quite a wagon at the moment. Let's move out west. Braves taking all three over the Colorado Rockies in Denver. Rockies go up 6-0 in the first game. Mickey Moniak hits his 9th home run, but the Braves come flying back. Homers from Olson and Harris. They win 8-6. Game two, Chris Sale laughs at your thin air. 7 innings, 1 earned, 11 Ks. Braves win that one 9-1. Spencer Strider makes his return in game three on Sunday. First start off the IL for him. He's not very good. 3 earned runs in 3 1/3. One of those did score after he came out. But the Braves rake. They put up 11. Win 11-6. Home runs from Jonah Heim and Jorge Mateo. Sure. The Braves have not lost the series this year. However, they did get some bad news. Ronald Acuna Jr. onto the IL with a hamstring strain. Now, he has not been that good this season. This team is doing it despite him, not because of him. However, they have zero organizational depth on the position player front. Their outfield on Sunday was Eli White, Mauricio Dubon, and Jose Azokar, which, you know, I'm not sure you can win a World
Series. Best team in baseball, folks. I mean, like, this was kind of the concern coming into the season, is certainly once Profar got suspended. They signed Mike Yastrzemski, and I really like that move, but he has been very bad. He is very near the top of the Why Haven't You Homered Yet leaderboard, so looking for his first long ball. And he's got a, it's not like he's doing much else. He's got a 266 on base. So he's been very disappointing, but he's going to have to step it up because he's going to keep playing. He's making a bunch of money, and he deserves to be starting out there. Listen, the top of this lineup right now, even without Acuna, what Baldwin and Olson are doing, I just mentioned previewing NL MVP.
Ozzy.
Between Ozzy, and Ozzy. I want to get to, we could talk about back. Ozzy in a second. Ozzy looks back. He is tied with Drake Baldwin for the National League lead in hits. But Baldwin is just, I mean, he's a machine. And then Olson, this is the best version of Olson we've seen in quite some time. I know he famously has not missed a game for 5 seasons, but after finishing 4th in MVP in 2023, the last 2 seasons, he has been very good. And because he's in the lineup every day, that's incredibly valuable. He has not been one of the best hitters in the National League the last 2 years. Now he looks like that again. And it shouldn't be that surprising because he has shown that at multiple times throughout his career. So to have those 2 guys at the top, to have Ozzy back, Austin Riley, man, that's...
He does not look good.
The Riley one is a tough conversation to have because that is someone they invested a lot in, and he is looking very, 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 very bad. And I don't really know what the alternative is there for that. Fortunately, they have all these other guys hitting, including Michael Harris, another guy they've invested in. He's been great. We know Dom Smith has been contributing. So they have this Riley, lead. They're pitching. Yeah.
7 more seasons, including this one, at $22 million a year.
Right. And he's been trending in the wrong direction. This is not just 1 month of looking worse. It has been getting worse for a while. So that is a difficult conversation to have, but a lot else is going great for them. Now they get Strider back. I'm not going to put too much stock into his first start back having to be at Coors Field. Like that, that sucks. And I assume he will ease into being more of a factor. And they've got Raisel Iglesias coming back to join a bullpen that Robert Suarez has been fantastic. That should be no surprise. And yeah, there's still some questions on the mound, kind of like Chicago. But when you've got Sale throwing like this, when you've got Bryce Elder looking better, you've got now Strider coming back in this awesome bullpen. And Richie is a homegrown guy that's starting to look really good. there's still a lot to like here with this Braves team. And yeah, the fact that they haven't lost a series all season, this would look like a very natural trap series to go to Colorado against the Rockies team that clearly doesn't stink. And they took care of business. See, they fall behind 6-0 and you're like, oh, maybe this is when they lose a series. No, not an issue. They rake their way back into it and now are off to their best start as a franchise since 1892. The Boston Bean Eaters, right? They were eating beans, baby, and they went on to win whatever the World Series was in 1892, which, as I went back
those
and looked,
MFers were eating beans.
They sure were. What a meme that is. 1892 Bean Eaters, who started 26-9, went on to win the World Series. It wasn't even called the World Series at the time, but they won a best of nine over the Cleveland Spiders. 1892, folks. So it's been a long time since the Braves have been this good to start a season. And people, they are how many games up in the National League East? They are 8.5 games ahead of the second place Marlins.
You think the guys on the Braves know they used to eat beans? Like, do you think they?
I don't know. Are they still eating beans?
Bean eater throwbacks. They should wear bean eater throwbacks.
They should. Okay, we have talked about how their City Connects have been so incredibly disappointing. Now, this doesn't really work because in this case, you'd be connecting to the city of Boston. Really want to do that. However,
They also don't want to connect to the city of Atlanta.
That's also true. So let's just connect to eating beans. It's more interesting than what you've done so far.
The bean connect. These are our legume connects.
Seed connect. The bean connect.
The legume connect jerseys.
Oh my gosh. They should wear them. We have the silly rivalry weekend coming up in a couple of weekends.
Yeah, against the Red
Sox. Will be all of, right? So all the rivalries that everyone talks about. And so that would be a good time to break out the bean connects. Okay, the Braves are incredible. Shout out to them. However, let's talk about another team that keeps winning. The Tampa Bay Rays, who took all three
over
the weekend.
How do they keep getting away with this?
Well, you know, it's a good way to do that is to play the San Francisco Giants, who are a bad baseball team. But we will focus on the positives right now, and that is the Tampa Bay Rays, who continue to win. They get their fourth sweep of the season, which is the most in baseball. They're only a game and a half behind those New York Yankees. Second best record in the American League, even with a run differential of a modest +7. Easily the most encouraging thing of their weekend is Shane McClanahan on Friday, who goes 6 scoreless. I talked to Shane briefly in Cleveland when they were here, and we've mentioned his kind of reactions to his early starts back after not pitching for multiple seasons and that competitive fire that is so clearly there with him and him holding this high standard for himself. I could tell talking to him this was last week, he's starting to feel it. He is feeling the stuff coming back. He feels that he can throw it in the box, but he hasn't really been able to throw it where he wants to throw it in the box. And you just think about how much better he got from when he made his debut to that just impact level that he was at before he got hurt. And he's starting to feel that again. And I know the Giants offense right now is a complete abomination, so that certainly helps matters. But really good to see Shane start to pick it up, just trending in the right direction. And I got to be honest, and they got some really bad news over the weekend, which is that Ryan Pepiot is going to be out for the year with hip surgery. And that's another pitcher that I was really excited about seeing this year. But when we continue to have conversations about how seriously to take the Rays, man, if Shane McClanahan is anything close to what he used to be, we're just having a different conversation about this team and what their options are and how seriously we should take them. And I know one starter can only do so much, but when you see what Yandy continues to do, Caminero heating up, they have some of their other newer hitters that have been solid. Aranda continues to be productive. Look, man, in this American League, why not? Why can't the Rays just be a postseason team? They're playing better baseball than any of these other teams. So credit to them.
I don't think they can win the division. They can absolutely win a wild card spot. The bottom of this lineup remains whatever.
Bad.
Guess what?
It's bad.
The Rays have made the playoffs before with worse bottom of the lineups than this. And so I trust the operation. I trust the run prevention. I trust the starting rotation, which I believe has the fourth lowest rotation ERA in the sport. The bullpen got off to an abysmal start, but has been much better recently. Brian Baker has been one of the best relievers in the entire game. The Rays are interesting. You know what's not interesting? Watching the San Francisco Giants play baseball.
Oh, my God.
This team absolutely stinks. Jordan, this is one of your biggest whiffs. Speaking of whiffs, the Giants, they do that a lot. Rafi Devers, we'll have a longer conversation about this at some point, but that is going to be a real problem. The first trade in MLB history that both teams lost catastrophically. Unbelievable that they were both able to do this. They have not hit a home run on the road since April 18th. They're 0-6 on this road trip, averaging 1.5 runs a game. 1.5 runs a game. You should never average fewer runs than you could score on a single. You know, that's just not what you're looking for. Where do they head next? The San Francisco Giants, they will head
their home.
Home to their play home. The Padres. Good luck to the Giants. Do they have the worst record in the NL? No, because the Mets. But they're one game better than the Mets. They're one game better than the Mets. Think about how many games the Mets lost in a row and how much energy we devoted to the Mets. The Giants are one game better than the Mets. I think they will probably finish the year worse off than the Mets. One more sweep to get to where we take a break and then we go fast. Royals taking all three over the Mariners as the Kansas City club gets back on track, climbing up the standings. Went 7-6 on Sunday. Home runs from the Italian brothers, Luigi and Mario, a.k.a. Vinny and Jack Caglione. They both go yard. Mariners hit four homers, including two from Julio. Lose anyway. Second consecutive stinker from Brian Wu. Game two, Emerson Hancock, who... Jordan, talk a little bit about Emerson Hancock being one of the best pitchers in the sport.
Dude.
It has been unbelievable. 14 Ks with zero walks over seven innings, and the Mariners lose anyway.
Yeah.
Felix smiling.
If you want to understand.
Felix
was there. He sure was, appropriately so. Listen, if you want to understand why Emerson Hancock is doing what he's doing, just go watch those highlights. The sweeper, they've lowered his arm slot a little bit. The velo's ticked back up. He's been able to hold it as a starter. And what that sweeper has been doing, I mean, I haven't looked whether it's rated as one of the best pitches in the league. I have to imagine after that start it does, from a run value standpoint and from just like a whiff standpoint, that is what a modern sweeper looks like. And when his velo has been sitting around 94, 95, he's throwing the four-seam and the two-seamer. He looks terrific. So he has been one of the best stories of the season for Seattle. Unfortunately, they are not hitting. And really concerning is that Cal Raleigh did not play the last two games of this series. That is notable for obvious reasons, because Cal Raleigh is really important to the Mariners. Surprise, surprise. It's also notable because Cal Raleigh has never been on the injured list, and we don't know if he's going to be on the injured list. They've just been very vague, general soreness, whatever. Still kind of doubt he's going to go on it, but him missing any amount of time is always notable. And you can see, especially since he's been playing better recently, what it does to take him out of the lineup. Good to see Julio heating up, but right now this offense is just not it. And credit to Kansas City, who pitched it really well. Bubich was fantastic on Sunday. Castillo was not. And it's not like the Royals were blasting the ball. I guess they were on Friday, but this is a really big series win for Kansas City. I was really impressed with them over the weekend. Seattle is still only, what, two and a half games back in the division because the division isn't very good. But this was not a great showing for Seattle, and a nice little run for Kansas City, who's now out of last place. They've passed Minnesota.
Out of last place, and an interesting stretch coming up for them. Home for three against Cleveland. Home for
four against Cleveland.
Four against Cleveland, three against Detroit. Mm-hmm. So the Royals jump up the standings in the AL Central this week. Okay, let's take a break. When we get back, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 more series to talk about, and certainly not enough time. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's crumple up all the other series, put them in a ball, and then talk about them really quickly. Turbo mode, right now.
Faster than fast, quicker than quick. I am lightning.
I feel the need for speed.
It's turbo time.
Cardinals taking 2 out of 3 over the Dodgers at home, staying hot. Birdos can't complete the sweep with a Dodgers win on Sunday as Justin Robleski continues to be one of the best pitchers in the game. The Dodgers took the Sunday one 4-1, but really impressive showing from the Cards, beating the Dodgers at home twice. How real is St. Louis? Still TBD. We got a homer from Jordan Walker on Saturday, homers from Gorman and Burleson on Friday. Their pitching showed up in games 1 and 2 with Libertor and McGreevy. The Cardinals are not elite, but they're certainly interesting. And after a couple years of total boredom at Busch Stadium, I think this is more than enough to dream on.
Justin Robleski is 5-0 with a 1.25 ERA in 36 innings. He has struck out 15 batters. And he has not allowed a home run. He has, I think, the lowest strikeout rate in the league, I imagine, for a starting pitcher. He doesn't even have like an elite ground ball rate, but the baseball gods are on his side. He is definitely a quality pitcher.
Is this our new Randy Vasquez?
No, because he's throwing strikes. I don't know what this is, but it is something to behold. So no, he's good. He's good at what he does.
There are 74 qualified starting pitchers. Okay.
Yep.
Right now, 74 of them. Robleski has the single lowest K per nine in the sport. Okay. 3.75 Ks per nine. The second to last is 5.49 Ks per nine, which hilariously is Michael McGreevy, who started for the Cardinals.
There you go.
And third is Matthew Libertor.
McGreevy, who both of whom beat the Dodgers on Friday and Saturday. So that is very funny. If you wanted to see strikeouts over the weekend in St. Louis, you were disappointed. The Dodgers offense is just going through one of those things where they all look bored and don't really feel like hitting. So I'm not too concerned about it. Let's go to the Angels and Mets. Oh boy, this was a bleak series to begin with. Two teams in very dark spots, but one of them had to win. And it turned out to be the New York Mets, who got a huge go-ahead home run from Ronnie Mauricio on Friday. They just
thumb on Saturday.
He breaks his thumb on Saturday, sliding into first base head first, which you should never do. Awful loss on Saturday. Nolan McClain looked bad for once. Oswald Peraza walk-off single. But the Mets are better than the Angels. I do feel good saying that. Clay Holmes was very terrific on Sunday. Mark Viandos hits two homers, and the Mets win that one. I mean, I guess what series win? You'll take what you can get. Are the Mets feeling good right now after now Mauricio breaking his thumb and now Bobichet's going to play short or Vidal Brujan or something? Probably not. Baby steps. You win a series. Whatever. You'll take it.
Baby steps. Wink. White Sox taking 2 out of 3 over the Padres. They can't complete the sweep. Padres win on Sunday. Mason Miller strikes out the ninth. Strikes out the side in the ninth for his 11th save. Good to see Griffin Canning back. He is on the Padres now. He blew out his ankle last year for the Mets after a really good start. 5 innings, 1 earned run. But the White Sox going into Petco and taking 2 out of 3, Murakami 13th homer. The White Sox are frisky. People were very mad that they were ranked last in everyone's power rankings last week. Jordan, they cannot be last in your power rankings this week. They just can't.
I'm going rankings next week. It helped that was right before I did it, right before they played the Angels. We knew it was going to be between those two teams, but no, they've played their way into 26. I don't know, but they're fun.
Who would you have at 30?
I'm enjoying watching them.
If you had to do it right now, who would you have at 30? Because who?
Angels, Giants, Rockies are the teams that are fighting for it right now. They're jockeying,
battling it out.
I would say whatever the opposite of the Kentucky Derby is.
The White Sox not being abysmal. Like, they will have stretches this year where they lose 6 in a row and as a result will probably finish in last in that division. But there is so much to watch here in a way that there hasn't been. And I do give this front office credit. The Murakami signing looks better and better and better. And I cannot believe that no one else took a chance on this guy at that price. Yes, maybe the league adjusts to him. Yes, there are some holes in the swing, but the juice is so real. 13 home runs, tied for the league in baseball. The White Sox have won the same number of games as the Guardians, Orioles, and D-backs. I think that says more about the those teams.
Same number of series. Not the same number of series. Games, but the same number of series. Yes. So again, if you break it up and you say, well, yeah, if you break it up and be like, okay, who's actually taken care of their series? The White Sox have actually done that, and credit to them. I do think they could finish fourth. I think that's in play with the direction the Twins season is going. Let's go to Washington, D.C., where the Milwaukee Brewers take the first two of this series. Jacob Mazurowski was going to throw a no-hitter on Friday. I don't really know how else to say it. He ends up leaving with a hamstring issue. But if you watched him for the first five innings, I know the pitch count was getting up there. The Nationals were not going to get a hit against Jacob Mazurowski on Friday. It was not going to happen. Maybe he would have been pulled before the end, even if he didn't get injured. He was throwing so hard. And not that this is new, but even for him, he was throwing so hard. And they looked a Nationals lineup and offense that, as we know, has been good, hopeless. They had no chance to get hit against him. Ultimately, they do not get the no-hitter or the combined no-hitter, but they do win that one. They win on Saturday. Kyle Harrison was fantastic as well. And then inexplicably, a Nats bullpen game gets the job done on Sunday. They win a close one, 3-2, to avoid getting swept. But Brewers, they kind of did what they needed to do here. As we know, they're going to have to do more than that to kind of keep pace in the NL Central, apparently. But I'm not too concerned about that.
There was a great quote from Nats manager Blake Butera, who, you know, is relatively new to this. He was like, how does anybody hit Jacob Mazurowski? He was like, I've never seen that kind of thing before. That's nuts. You know, he's like, we've seen McClain and we've seen these guys. What was this?
I mean,
I'm
telling you. It was going to be a no. He's going to throw one at some point. There's no way. There is essentially no. It's going to become a matter of efficiency, and the Brewers let him do it, and Murph let him do it. So he's going to have to get some early outs on some weak ground outs, but it's going to happen. When he's on, looks to be the most unhittable pitcher in the league, starter at least. So,
Guardians taking 2 out of 3 over the A's in Sacktown. Chase DeLauder, 4 hits on Friday. Bizzana gets his first career hit on Saturday. Home runs from Hedges, Fry, and Manzardo. The big bashing Guardians take that one 14-6. Langeliers hits 2 home runs. He has 10 of those. He's probably just one of the best catchers in the league. Nick Kurtz ends his walk streak at 20. Game 3, A's avoid the sweep. DeLauder, he goes yard in that one. All YOLO County besides that. Messick allows 3 homers in his worst start of the season as the A's win 7-1. Let's head over to Boston, where the Red Sox, with their new manager, things are looking just as bad. They win the first one 3-1 on Friday, but then it's all Astros from there. 6-3 them on Saturday, 3-1 and 10 on Sunday. We have Seydon Rafaela getting mad at Trevor Story on the field. We have Ranger Suarez leaving with a hamstring problem on Sunday. We have a ballpark proposal on the big screen where the proposed says no thanks to the proposer. Just not what you're looking for in what is still Beantown.
We have Wilson Contreras afterwards being like, yeah, I don't know. The vibes have kind of changed since Cora left. They're playing more loose, but also we're still young and making mistakes. We have young players. Then Marcelo Meyer, 30 seconds later, is like, of course you blame the young players. That's an easy thing to do. No, we all got to do better. And by the way, I also frankly feel bad for Chad Tracy, because what a ridiculous thing to then. I know he's getting this opportunity, and he knows all these guys. You know who he doesn't know at all, and I don't Wilson Contreras. Why would Wilson Contreras doesn't care? He just got traded here, and he has no relationship to Chad Tracy. Not that he should be, you know, obnoxious to him, but if we've learned anything from the start of this season, is that Wilson Contreras will tell us how he's feeling. He does not owe any of these people anything. And so, and that he's also true. Been playing well. He's one of the few guys that's actually performed. So he's probably like, I'll tell you what I'm feeling. And that is not making things any better. So not feeling great about things with the Red Sox. I think the one takeaway for Houston from this series, Spencer Arrighetti, they are so desperate for any amount of competence and consistency in the rotation right now with all their injuries. And it seems like Spencer Arrighetti, who we did see him look like that earlier on in his career, it seems like he could provide that.
Phillies taking 2 out of 3 over the weekend in Miami. They'll play again today. This is better from the Philadelphia Phillies. Zach Wheeler, 6 innings, 1 earned on Sunday. Bryson Stott, first home run of the year. They win, hang on late. Game 2, Max Meyer dominant against the Phillies as the Fish win 4-0. Phillies bounce back for 6 in the first inning on Sunday off Chris Paddock, including a 3-run bomb from Stott. Jesus Luzardo is great. Phillies win that 7-2. They're playing better baseball. They're playing better baseball. Don Mattingly, he said that phrase like 1,000 times during his press conference. We need to play better baseball, and they are doing that. Interesting news out of Miami. Agustin Ramirez, who was very fun to watch as a rookie last year, sent down AAA, optioned. And they are calling up Joe Mack, one of their top prospects, one of the best catching prospects in the sport. A Buffaloer. That's the thing I should know, considering we're now, you know, kind of from there. What are you rubbing your head? What is it?
Yeah.
Buffalone?
Isn't it a Buffalonian? Got to be a Buffalonian.
Buffalonian?
Right? Yeah. Buffalonian.
Yeah, come on Buffalonian. Now. I just hopefully, think about them as Sabres fans.
That's true. Well, hopefully Joe Mack can find time to watch game 1 when he's also maybe going to be busy making his major league debut. But yeah, I mean, at the very least, Joe Mack's going to improve the defense, and it's not like Agustin Ramirez was hitting either. So well earned there, and a homegrown prospect for Miami, which is rare because so many of their guys they've gotten in trades. Now they get someone that they've actually drafted and developed, and he will be a big leaguer. So good for Joe Mack. 2 more series. The Twins and Blue Jays split a 4-game set. Byron Buxton and Kazuma Okamoto. That was kind of the story of the weekend. Both of those guys hit a bunch of home runs. Okamoto heating up is very, very, very exciting to see for Toronto and very important as George Springer got plunked in the same foot that he already had a broken left toe in. It seems like he avoided it being another IL stint, but still, Springer has not been the same impact bat that we have, you know, saw from him last year. And so they need some more offense. Okamoto looks like he's providing that. Joe Ryan left his start on Sunday with, I think, forearm tightness or something. That is really bad for so many reasons for the Twins, whether they intend to hang around and try to be 500 or they intend to trade Joe Ryan. That would obviously be a disaster if he is very injured and would be a huge bummer for one of the best pitchers in the American League. But the Twins do win on Sunday, which is frustrating for Toronto as they try and climb back up the standings. They are still 2 games under 500.
Tigers took 2 out of 3 over the Rangers in a Peacock has been good. Those games have been the broadcast has been good. They are picking some weird series. Weird ones. Rangers, Tigers, respectfully, Sunday Night Baseball. Didn't watch. Watched hockey instead. Tigers won 7-1 on Sunday. They won 5-1 on Saturday. They're probably the second best team in the American League. Maybe third best.
Yeah. But case for it.
This
definitely
month is
case for it.
Case for it. April and May is just about treading water. Both of these teams are doing that well enough. Let's check back in later on in the season. Who do we have on Sunday Night Baseball this week, Jordan?
You're not going to be very happy about it. Coming up, we've got Tigers Royals and then Padres Mariners. And then Rangers Angels.
What? Benetti, come back on the pod.
Well, dude,
I know this
mean,
is not
anything,
your job.
I'm just glad it's Benetti now. Because if it wasn't, I really wouldn't be watching.
Look, like, there should just be some balance between. I like getting some other teams some looks here on the big show, but like, I want Braves Dodgers Sunday Night Baseball. I do. Even Cardinals Padres is more interesting. You know, like,
sure.
I really am surprised about how lackluster the Sunday Night Baseball schedule has been so far. I know we have like a nice run in there in the middle, like of the season where there's some heavy hitters.
Oh yeah, they loaded up later on, but I don't disagree with you. It has been a strange slate. Okay, we're done. We did it. We did another podcast. Can you believe
it? Go Sabres.
Another one down. Go Sabres. Go. Game one on, it's Tuesday, right? Or do we have to wait all the way until Wednesday? We do have to wait all the way until Wednesday.
The hockey playoffs are confusing.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
From a scheduling perspective, like they're starting series before other ones have even finished. I don't get it.
Yeah, they do that. So we do have to wait all the way until Wednesday. So we will hit you with another Go Sabres on Wednesday's episode. But until then, thank you for listening. BaseballBarbercast@gmail.com. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and TJ Brassel for producing. We will talk to you all later this week. Bye-bye.